morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today's date is May 24th, 2022. We're ready for the second matter on our oral argument calendar, so I'll ask the marshal to call the case.
Now calling case number 821-1105, State of Minnesota versus Isaias De La Cruz Soto.
And counsel, I have just a few comments that I'd like to make before we start arguments. I know you're familiar with our proceedings and in particular I have also come to understand when we proceed by Zoom, how those things unfold. I just want to point out a couple of things for you. So this is a matter that is being heard orally. There should be a timer visible on your screen. You should keep an eye on it. It goes the same way it's gone if you're in the courtroom or previously done a Zoom argument. We ask you, because we maintain an audio recording of this proceeding on our website, we ask you to identify yourself as well as the client you represent before you start your remarks. So with that, since we have counsel for both sides here, I will ask counsel for appellant to begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Sharon Jacks, and I'm the Assistant State Public Defender representing Isaias De La Cruz Soto in his challenge to his criminal sexual conduct convictions. Today, I'd like to focus on the first issue raised in appellant's brief, and that is that the appellant was denied his constitutional rights to a 12-person unanimous jury. He invoked his right to have the jury polled, and in doing so, invoked his right to ensure that the verdict in this matter was unanimous. Polling is designed to make sure that every juror approves of the verdict and has an opportunity to express to the district court that if they feel they have been pressured in some way or have made a mistake after the court originally hears the verdict. The verdict isn't complete and a district court cannot receive it until all 12 jurors are polled. So when a defendant invokes a right to polling to ensure unanimity, each and every one of the jurors has to be polled and affirm that the verdict is their true and correct verdict. And that simply didn't happen here. What the certified record to this court indicates is that 11 jurors were polled and indicated that this was their true and correct verdict. Because that violates the criminal procedure rules as well as case law with respect to unanimity and polling, that error was plain. There are two reasons.
Can I ask you just to make sure I understand your argument fully? Do you contend that only 11 jurors deliberated?
We contend two things. On this record, it can't be said that 12 jurors actually deliberated. And secondly, if 12 jurors did deliberate, the right to unanimity was still violated because 12 jurors were not polled. Okay, and that makes this case different than Mahmoud, which it appears from the face of the decision that was a challenge only to the right to have a 12-person jury. And there was no challenge, at least the opinion does not address the issue of unanimity. It's also what distinguishes this case from this case that the state relies on, State versus Diaz. In that case too, the analysis by the court states the frames the issue as a violation of the right to, a 12-person jury and not the violation of the right to a 12-person jury and the unanimity of that jury.
Counsel, though, you're assuming that this juror was never polled and ignoring the fact that it could have just been a technical error by the court reporter in not capturing that part of the record, as is indicated in some case law anyway.
No, Your
Honor. Why would we accept that when you haven't even requested a Schwartz hearing to interview the juror to see if he was polled, which would seem to be very simple?
Your Honor, we're not speculating about anything. We're relying on the record here that this court must accept. It's a certified record. The the court reporter certified to this court that it is a true and accurate transcription of the proceedings. And it indicates that only 11 jurors were polled. It's not a situation where the defense would attempt to impeach the official record. The rules of appellate procedure permit the state to file a motion if they had information that would indicate 12 jurors were actually polled. The state didn't do that here. Furthermore, a Schwartz hearing wouldn't be the procedure by which the record would need to be corrected. This doesn't have to do with some sort of misconduct on the part of the jury. It's simply that the district court here failed to pull all 12 jurors, and therefore under settled case law, that was a violation of the right to unanimity.
Ms. Jacks, here's what I'm struggling with respect to both of the issues you've raised. Is our standard a review? I mean, plain error, the whole notion is that in most cases, the error can be corrected if it's plain, if it was raised in the first instance. And I mean, it's very, both the Bay case, Muhammad case have, I think, presented situations where the transcript seems to suggest that all the jurors weren't polled, but nobody who was in the courtroom. And in this case, you had a jury that was out for 2.5 hours, right? And so, the fact that you would lose somebody that either they didn't deliberate or they weren't polled, it's hard when we don't presume error for me to say, okay, this is the principled reason why I would agree with your argument and say, absolutely, this transcript just shows there were only 11 jurors polled, end of story.
Yeah, I understand that, Your Honor, that it is frustrating that the defense didn't object here. However, that is why we're proceeding under the plein air standard, and we understand our burden is more difficult here as a result. I would point the court to a variety of appellate courts in other jurisdictions that under these almost identical circumstances did in fact find that there was a violation of the right to unanimity and that violation was structural error. There's People versus Jackson from Illinois. There's the California appellate case, Traugott. There's the Poindexter case from the Supreme Court of North Carolina. In all of those cases, there was evidence that in fact all 12 jurors had deliberated. They had signed the verdict forms, but the district court either by accident or by choice after a juror had left the courtroom, only polled 11 jurors. And all three of those courts indicated that was a violation of the right to unanimity, because when a defendant asks for polling, it is the mechanism for ensuring unanimity. It is not simply a mechanism for ensuring unanimity. And then those courts went on to hold that error was structural error for a couple of reasons. It's structural error because it's impossible for the appellate court to evaluate or quantitatively measure what impact the error had on the verdict. There's no way of knowing what the juror here would have done had he been asked by the court whether or not he agreed with the verdict. Secondly, an error in polling is considered a defect that goes to the mechanism of the trial itself, of it goes to unanimity, which is fundamental to the criminal justice system. And we would compare the violation of the right to unanimity to the violation of the right to a public trial. That's a right that is deemed to be so highly valued and such a bedrock part of our criminal justice system that even if the trial was otherwise fair, and even if the evidence is otherwise sufficient, appellate courts reverse for a new trial to vindicate that right when the public has been refused access to part or all of a trial. And similarly, unanimity is so fundamental to our criminal justice system, and that in order to ensure that the right is vindicated, a this matter should be reversed and remanded for a new trial to vindicate the right. The unanimity, the polling and unanimity requirement all go to the accuracy of the verdict. It is the opportunity for the juror to disavow the verdict or indicate that they made some mistake or that they had felt pressured. So we can't know here whether or not all 12 jurors found appellant guilty of all of these offenses. Now, as you know, with respect to burden, we also have under the plain air standard this extra burden of demonstrating to this court that, you know, even where there is error, it would, in order to ensure the integrity and fairness and public confidence in the justice system, reversal is necessary. And I know there's some case law that indicates if there's structural error, we don't need to meet that burden, but I don't think that's fully settled at this time. And so I am going to make an argument that we have met that burden. In our brief, we cite to State versus Little. That's a case similar to this where the defendant was being tried both for a first degree criminal sexual conduct and third degree criminal sexual conduct. The court obtained a waiver of the defendant's right to a jury on the third degree count, but not on the first degree count. And after finding plain error that affected the defendant's substantial rights, the Supreme Court indicated that under prong four, they were reversing to ensure public confidence in the criminal justice system. And the same is necessary here because it's just universally accepted that a person is not going to prison unless 12 peers have unanimously determined that they are guilty of whatever crime has been alleged. And if this court doesn't reverse, it sends a message that that if 11 jurors find you guilty, you can go to prison too. And as with the right to have a jury determine guilt in Little, it would undermine public confidence and fairness in the system if this court does not reverse. You know, having said that, again, I'd like to reiterate that because it's structural error, I don't think this court really needs to head on in and even address the fourth prong. But if it does, we'd ask that you follow State versus Little and reverse for a new trial. If the court has no further questions, we'll.
So counsel, I'll just ask one. You made a quick reference that here, this is a case where the state did not file a motion to correct the record, and presumably in this case would have said that 12 jurors deliberated and maybe have amended the transcript to say that there was the 12th juror was polled and agreed with the verdict. So if that had happened in this case, I'm guessing you'd say, you know, that would end it, right? There would be no issue. If that motion had been made by the state and granted by the district court, I think you understand the procedure. Yeah.
Correct. Had the record been corrected before the appeal, you know, before the court, the case had been submitted to the court, then the official record would indicate that 12 jurors had been polled. And the record would have to indicate not just that 12 had deliberated, but that 12 had actually been polled and affirmed that it was their true and correct verdict. That didn't happen here. Presumably the court reporter was unable to, the court reporter indicated that only 11 had been pulled, or the court reporter wasn't.
Well, the record would show if the state had made a motion. I don't think we're missing that part. We all understand that motion wasn't made. I was just, it's a hypothetical question in this case.
Yeah.
But if it had happened, it would eliminate the first issue in this appeal. Isn't that right?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Is there anything further from either panel member? Okay. And of course, Ms. Jax, we appreciate the argument so far. If you choose, you've got 5 minutes for rebuttal. So the clock has been reset, and counsel for respondent, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Travis Smith, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota, in this appeal. Appellant asks this court to reverse his conviction and order a new trial based on two assignments of error. First, appellant claims that because the transcript does not capture a polling response from a 12th juror, that is, rights to a 12-person jury and to a unanimous verdict were violated. This court should reject that argument for the same reasons it rejected them in State versus Bay. And I note that a counsel for appellant, she distinguished Mahmoud and she distinguished the Arizona Supreme Court's decision in State versus Diaz that I cited in my brief. She has not distinguished State v. Bay. And that's because State v. Bay, decided by this court, although a non-precedential opinion last summer, is indistinguishable from the present case. And this court refused to make the assumption that appellant is asking this court to make today, that everyone in the courtroom didn't notice that the 12th juror wasn't polled, even though the transcript only showed that 11 jurors were polled. Appellant is asking this court to presume error, to presume that the judge didn't ask the 12th juror if the verdict represented his true and correct verdict, that defense counsel sat idly by while the court skipped one of the jurors, while the prosecutor sat idly by while the district court skipped one of the jurors, that even the 12th juror himself didn't speak up and say, "You didn't ask me."
Let me ask you this, Mr. Smith. I appreciate your argument, and I think what we've said in some non-precedential decisions, and your argument to us is that there are certain circumstances where we should not accept the record from the district court as accurate. And because of the reason that it's unlikely that in fact things unfolded in this case, in Bay, in Muhammad, as the transcript would indicate. But it seems like it's a dangerous, slippery slope to start. District courts are courts of record, and we do our work by reviewing the record. Is it just we should disregard the record on this particular issue, or is there a reason for us to think that this transcript is suspect in this regard, in this set of facts?
I think there are, and I think this comes down to a very practical issue. We're talking about a body in a chair. It's not like there was an empty chair. This is where bare transcripts, right, can never accurately reflect what's going on in the courtroom, because everyone has eyes to see in addition to ears to hear.
So, and counsel, if you don't mind. Yeah. Okay. So you're sort of implying, you're right, of course, that counsel, the defendant, the judge were present in the courtroom and able to see what was going on. Right. That's not our record. Right. We don't have a video recording of the district court proceedings. So what we have is the transcript, and the transcript reflects a polling of 11 jurors. So I think, with due respect, what this court is trying to ask you is, when we have a transcript that shows only a polling of 11 jurors, how do we then assume that what you're saying, which is that 12 jurors were present, deliberated, and were polled, and were unanimous, when that's not what the transcript says? And as you know, our rules say it's the transcript, that is the record in this case, not what you or the trial lawyer that day, trial lawyers and the defendant saw. It's the transcript.
Well, I think two things. First, this is a question of plain error. Mm-hmm. It's not a question of objected to error. And we seem to be losing sight of the fact that error is not presumed. And I think we need to carefully distinguish between the question of whether the transcript reflects 12 jurors being polled, whether 12 jurors were in fact polled, and whether 12 jurors did in fact deliberate, especially as we get into structural error. The other thing that I think is important to bear in mind here is the fact that this is something that is certainly easily remedied. This could be remanded for a hearing where the district court could poll the 12th juror. There was an extended discussion during oral argument before the Supreme Court in State versus Bay about exactly that remedy. And ultimately, obviously, we don't know how the Supreme Court's going to decide State versus Bay. But the other thing is, this is the way this court has decided these cases consistently over a decade. I've made the arguments based on how this court has decided these cases.
And you're referring there to Mohamed and Bay, right?
Correct.
Yeah. And those are non-precedential opinions. I mean, they're important, and you're right, they're very similar to this one, but they are non-precedential. And we're in this unique spot where the Supreme Court has already granted review and heard the Bay case.
Certainly.
Is this a situation where we should hold our decision until we hear from the Supreme Court on the Bay case?
I certainly think that would be a reasonable course of action in this case, is to hold on to this decision until the Supreme Court decides Bay. Because it's dispositive of this issue. If the state loses in Bay, then I think the state loses here. If the state prevails in Bay, then I don't think this case, as I've said, is meaningfully distinguishable from State versus Bay. And there would be probably some interest in judicial economy that would be served by waiting for that decision to come down from the Supreme Court, since we are in that position. In any event, I want to address a little bit this argument that the failure to poll is structural error and the reliance upon People v. Jackson from Illinois. First of all, I would point out that People v. Jackson, the Illinois Court of Appeals decision, is a departure from the prior law in Illinois, the prior way the Court of Appeals in Illinois had decided those cases. It's based on a different plain error, structural error scheme. Illinois scheme is different than ours. And moreover, I think the Supreme Court's decision in Polzinski, the recent decision there, throws into serious question whether jury polling would qualify as structural error under our understanding of structural error in Minnesota. I would note that in State versus Plantain, this court, unlike the Illinois Court of Appeals, held that jury polling is not the mechanism by which unanimity is ensured. This court expressed much stronger preference. In fact, it said that the instructions regarding unanimity are the mechanism, the more important mechanism indeed, to ensure jury unanimity. And so there is, as far as I'm aware, no case law in Minnesota that says that failure to poll all 12 jurors is structural error. In fact, I think that's one of the questions being argued and considered in State versus Bay. And certainly this court's decisions in Bay and in Mahmoud don't reflect an understanding that that was structural error. And I think it was particularly interesting with regard to the question of structural error is that structural errors are typically involve rights that have to be personally waived. Jury polling isn't like that. Jury polling in Minnesota only happens on request of a party. Now, the district court, as a matter of practice, always asks whether the parties wish to have the jury polled, but it's not something, as far as I'm aware, that the law says must happen unless somebody affirmatively waives it. In fact, the rules, I think, say it must happen upon request of a party, and that's different. And that's not the way other structural errors work. Those are, especially in the criminal context, we're talking about things that have to be personally waived by the defendant, and we have processes that we go through in order to ensure those things. And even some structural errors, as Polzinski holds, are subject to the fourth prong of the plain error analysis, which is that that the appellant must show that failure to correct the error will substantially affect the public integrity, the reputation of fairness of the judiciary generally. And I submit that I think Bay, to a certain extent, this court's decision in Bay reflects this notion where it would be bizarre, quite frankly, to say that the public expects this court to reverse errors just because the transcript doesn't show that the 12th juror was polled. And to expect the public to believe that everyone in the courtroom who has an interest in ensuring that the defendant has a fair trial completely missed the fact that either a 12th juror didn't answer the question or wasn't asked the question or was in fact not present. Because let's be clear, appellant suggests that this juror was not present when the jury was polled.
I think counsel has articulated a couple of options. One is perhaps the 12th juror wasn't present. One is perhaps that the 12th juror wasn't unanimous. I mean, we don't know because the 12th juror wasn't polled. So that brings me to my question, Mr. Smith, and I'm curious, you didn't touch on it so far. So counsel for appellant mentioned that, you know, the transcript that we're dealing with in appellant's opinion clearly reflects this, you know, failure to vindicate the defendant's right to poll the entire jury because we don't have a unanimous jury because we don't have a 12th juror polled. So that you're saying, of course, wrong assumption, it happened. Look, nobody commented on it. So why didn't the state file a motion to correct the transcript when you saw this appeal coming? That's certainly a procedural option available to you, and you're saying it would have been granted. So why didn't it happen?
Well, I think the primary reason that I didn't pursue such a motion was in reliance on the way this court has analyzed the issue in Mahmoud and Bay. And if that was a wrong decision on my part, given the fact that those weren't precedential opinions, that was a wrong decision on my part. But I also I go back to the argument that that we're in plain error land. And it is the appellant's heavy burden to demonstrate that there was an error, that that error was plain, that the error itself, which is, if we're being precise, the failure to poll, substantially affected the appellant's rights, and that error of alleged failure to poll was such that it calls into question the fairness and integrity of judicial proceedings generally. And that's the appellant's heavy burden. And the state on appeal is not the one bearing the burden of demonstrating that there wasn't error. This is, I mean, the apple cart is turned upside down here. It's the appellant who has to demonstrate that there was error. And then we're here on plain error, so that burden is even heavier.
Doesn't the transcript meet that burden? I mean, the transcript shows only 11 jurors were polled, doesn't reference a 12th juror at all. Why isn't that enough to meet the burden?
First of all, it reflects immediately before that the court asked the jurors if it was their true and correct verdict, and the jury as a whole said it was. The other point is, I think we need to be a little bit more clear about what Minnesota law is about when a verdict is complete. And State v. Crow and the statute make it clear that a verdict is complete when the verdict has been read in open court and no juror has expressed dissent. It's not when all jurors have been polled. That's not the law in Minnesota. And no juror expressed dissent. They were given an opportunity to when the judge asked the entire panel. Then the jurors were individually polled, and no juror expressed dissent throughout that entire process. And the verdict was complete at that point in time. We're not waiting for a verdict to be complete because the 12th juror wasn't polled. So to the extent that there's an argument about harm, whether the error was caused some harm to the appellant, under Minnesota law, the verdict was complete. The verdict was received in open court and no juror expressed dissent. That's the important piece, I think, to bear in mind here, is the question of completeness of the verdict is whether the verdict has been read in open court and no juror has expressed dissent. And in light of that fact, in light of the fact that the record amply demonstrates that 12 jurors did in fact deliberate, that the court asked the jury if it represented their true and correct verdict and no one expressed dissent. Any alleged error here did not affect the defendant's substantial rights and does not call into question the fairness and integrity of judicial proceedings generally. Accordingly, even if there was error, the defendant's not entitled to relief. I would therefore ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. So we've reset the clock, Ms. Jax, and you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose.
Thank you. Just like to touch on State versus Bay. As noted before, in State versus Mahmoud, the court didn't address the issue of unanimity, and the Bay court relied almost exclusively on Mahmoud in affirming. And I do not know if distinction was recognized by the court. The court didn't go into any sort of independent analysis of unanimity, so I don't think it's particularly persuasive.
What about your response to my question? I mean, since the Supreme Court has granted review in Bay, and this is one of the issues, if not perhaps the only issue, I haven't checked that, but that the Supreme Court's going to decide, should we stay our decision until we hear from the Supreme Court?
I don't have any objection to that, because if you issue a decision, the court will grant either our petition or the state's petition for review and stay it pending their decision in May. So it's not going to impact the speed at which my client receives a decision on the matter. I'm not sure of the mechanism to do that, whether or not the appellate rules permit it, a sua sponte stay. I'm not clear on that, but appellant has no objection to the court doing that.
What about going to your last comment, so about Bay and Mahmoud, the argument that Mr. Smith was making on behalf of the respondent was that Minnesota law, the verdict's complete when it's read in open court and there's no dissent by a juror, and that happened here. The jurors affirmed their verdict as a group. And then the request was made for polling, and we just have 11. So how do you respond to that argument? Because that's also not mentioned in Bay and Mahmoud.
Yeah, we disagree to that interpretation of the law. I think Crow and Burns indicate that where jurors are asked, or where the defense asks for polling, that the verdict is complete only if each and everyone indicated that it's there. True and accurate verdict. And I also think Rule 2603, Subdivision 20, I believe it is, specifically or expressly states that when requested, the court shall poll each and every juror. And I believe it goes on to indicate when the verdict is complete, or at least it implies that. So I ask the court to look at that rule as well as Crow and Burns. If the court has no further questions, we just ask that to ensure that appellant was convicted by 12 peers who unanimously found him guilty of all of these offenses, that the court grant him a new trial.
Any other questions from the panel? Doesn't appear to be okay. Thank you so much to the lawyers in this case. We very much appreciate hearing your arguments and have appreciated this opportunity to have a conversation with you. With that, the argument now is complete and the matter is submitted to this court for its decision. So we'll issue a decision within the statutory timeframe. Thank you.
Thank you.